All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Man vs. Mob Radio. This is your host, Patrick Clerkin, and you are listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. If you have never heard my voice before, it's on every Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. And to give you a little bit of an idea of what Man vs. Mob Radio is, it is a freeform program where really my main goals are to try to bring people together, to try to make them think, to try to make them question what they know, and to challenge them, and to entertain them, of course. So tonight's show is actually a great show. We have a great show in store for you. And across from me right now is my roommate and a pretty interesting guy, Jake. And I'll be talking with him about his very interesting life and experiences. But I should first pimp my podcast and radio show, because I don't do that enough, actually, and I should start doing it more. So I do have a podcast version of this show. It's called Man vs. Mob, and the verse is a V, so Man v. Mob. And if you're looking for it, it's at www.manvmobpodcast.com, and it's also on Spotify, and it's on Apple Podcasts. And also follow me on social media. I have an Instagram and Twitter account. Starting to get into the Twitter, not too great at it yet, but I'll be building that up. But it's at Man vs. Mob Podcast. Once again, M-A-N-V-M-O-B. And one other thing that I should mention is that this radio program, part of what makes it great is your participation and collaborating with you. So if you have anything that you want to say, any comments that you want to make, any requests, if you just want to interact with us in the studio live, we have a direct call-in line, which is 855-915-9636. Once again, 855-915-9636. And those last four digits are actually WMFO, which is the studio. So, let's see. Now I can switch it over to the purpose of tonight's show, which is me having a conversation with Jake. So, let me introduce really what brought this idea about. So, about 3 weeks ago, I came back from the radio program that I was having that night, and I don't know, I was in the kitchen making some food, Jake was doing his thing, and we got into talking, had like a 4-hour conversation basically, and it's funny when you live with someone and you realize how little you actually know about them, but all I really knew about him beforehand was that he was from Ohio, that he was a banker, that he was a little bit older than me, and that he had at one point been married, or there was some story related to that. That's really all that I knew. So I guess I should say that that was a very enlightening conversation that I had with him. And I found out that he had previously been involved with a religious sect known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. You've probably heard of them before. And that he grew up heavily involved with them, and that he eventually sort of became disenfranchised and broke away from it. So before I continue to just ramble here, I just want to say that one of the reasons why I found his story so compelling, and it's just fascinating, I feel that it really needed to be told, but one of the reasons why I find it very compelling, particularly now, is because a lot of people are very very hive-minded and don't really question whatever their belief is. They're not very critical. They don't think critically. So whether you're the social justice people or the Trump people or whatever your thing is, you don't really question, per se, what you're into. So anyway, Jake, I'm going to hand it over to you now, but I wanted to say, what exactly was your experience with this type of hive mind and this type of insular groupthink?
Sure. Yeah, and I would agree. I think it was really interesting. I think on a dual level, we kind of had that where, you know, it's almost like strangers living together, and everybody has a story. And I think that's what I want to convey with this, is that, you know, everybody does have their individual stories, and we might not understand their point of view, whether it be, you know, one side of the aisle or the other side of the aisle, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. I mean, my experience with them was you know, I was involved pretty heavily within the religion for the majority of my life. And then it was very interesting eventually finding out that, you know, the things that I had been brought up to believe, when you're inside of an organization like that, it's just what your life is what your experience is. So unless there's a need to start questioning things, it's rare that you would do that. I reached a point in my life where I did start to question some of the things that I had been raised to believe and some of the experiences that I had had, you know, from all the way from being a small child to even an adult. So I was associated with them until my late 20s, almost 30s, and again, quite heavily. So that was my initial experience with the organization.
So what kind of pushback did you get initially when you started questioning early on?
Well, I didn't get a lot of pushback because the approach that I took was a little bit more singular focused. So, you know, within the organization, if you start to express doubts in an open way or in a public way, you'd receive immediate repercussions from that. You know, from within the congregation, you know, you might even feel that you could confide in someone, but what you come to find out quickly is that, you know, there's no real loyalty there when it comes to having critical thinking or having free thinking. So for myself, it was something I was very hesitant to pursue. As you mentioned, I was married while part of the religion. Mm-hmm. And even with my spouse, it wasn't something that I was comfortable talking about. It wasn't something with friends that I had known from childhood to talk about. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was something that I kept very private. Forums like this, mainly the internet, really is what let me have an outlet to do independent research, to be able to understand some of the things that I was taught in a larger context, because everything's very, very insular. So that was really what I experienced. Wasn't a lot of pushback until I had made my mind up that this wasn't the right religion for me, or that this wasn't the right kind of organization for me. And then from that point, it's the pushback is immediate. So my
just
friend,
ratchets up right away.
Yeah. So as soon as you've done anything that kind of falls outside of the rules of the religion, there's pretty immediate consequences to it. Mm-hmm. So in my case, those consequences were, you know, losing my social network, losing my employment at the time was actually with a business that was run by someone in the same congregation that I went to. So I saw immediate change in my work experience there as well. And in fact, ended up leaving that job, we'll say mutually, within about 6 months after leaving the religion, because then the workplace became kind of an extension of the ostracism that is received from within the organization, from within the religion.
So your life was pretty much fully blended together. It's like you can't really compartmentalize like that at that time.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you're talking your friends, your family. For me, it was my employment. It's not the way for everyone. It just so happened to be in my case. Mm-hmm. My employment. So pretty much everything was around there. So when I did start to have some of those questions, some of those doubts, and I guess at this point I wouldn't even call them doubts because I had already made my mind up that they were incorrect, I started to kind of plan an exit strategy a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So I realized the situation I was in. I realized that employment was going to have to change. I realized that the family situation was going to have to change, and that my living situation would have to change. So to the best of my ability, I tried to start putting a little bit of money aside, kind of started looking for a new job, that sort of thing, to try to get my ducks in a row, as it were, before making that huge leap that I knew was about to happen.
The initial commitment that you made, was it to go about it solo? And did you commit to that? Or were you sort of looking for little things, little dissatisfactions that you might see in other people? Even just eye movements or little things that you could pick up on and maybe try to say, hey, maybe I could come to trust that person and confide in them and see if they think the way that I'm thinking. Because I would imagine there would be a tendency to think that way, but then also trying to crush that idea down, because if you give yourself away to somebody who ends up spoiling your whole exit strategy, then the cost is too great. So did you have to grapple with that?
Yeah, definitely. So I don't think I ever came to that point for me being being who I was and how involved I was in it. Mm-hmm. I would have been ultra skeptical of anyone who was going to express things that I would have wanted to express.
Oh, okay.
And so I just personally didn't even want to take that risk. I kind of knew what the answer would be. That sure, there were certain things, you know, I can think of, like with a friend I was very close to, like personal matters that I might share with him. And his answers would be very much cookie cutter, was very much, you know, kind of a parrot of what you would be taught at one of the meetings or, mm-hmm. you know, in some of the literature that they might give to you, that sort of thing. So, you know, even those sort of little things with people that I thought that I could maybe trust, you know, kind of was evident to me that, you know, if I wanted to get what I wanted to get out of life after this, that wasn't the way to go for me. That it was something that I probably had to do alone, yes.
Man, what a realization, huh?
Yeah.
It's a little bit liberating, I'm sure, but also intensely frightening, pretty much, right? For the, at least in a social sense. I mean, maybe, I don't know if you ever felt physically threatened, but this is also what fascinates me, is people think that others get stuck in these situations purely because of physical threats that are put against them. And the fear of physical abuse or something like that, or violence. But a lot of this is heavily socially based, I think, mm-hmm. and just the fear of ostracism and isolation. And yeah, that can be pretty deeply compelling for people.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I mean, so I would say, you know, I'm not going to put a percentage on it or anything like that, but I would just say I know that there are people who don't take those steps because of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's always there, that unspoken threat that your life's going to change if you don't follow the rules. And it's going to change in a way that's negative, really, whether you can help it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because again, your entire social structure is set up there. Even if you do have some connections outside of the organization, I mean, it's still very difficult because you're... you know, the people that you would come to trust or even your own family are all going to be part of that, and you're going to lose that. You know, so there's, I know that there are some people who maybe take a more, you know, a more approach of slowly fading mm-hmm. away. For me, when I make up my mind on something, I take action on it usually. So I think that's, you know, a little bit of a different approach than others might take. But that's what it meant for me was, you know, I was all in when I was in, and I'm all out now that I'm out.
Yeah. That's probably the smartest way to do it. It seems to me, at least, there has to be a lot of enticement to maybe try to maintain some threads
mm-hmm.
or to try to pick and choose, but you're probably just making the process less likely to succeed if you try to do that. So hopefully, you know, anybody that goes through something like that can try to make amends with some aspects of it later. But I think you probably did the right thing at the forefront to just say, all right, I'm out.
Yeah. Well, and like you said, it's very, it's very much your social structure, right? So what you'd be asking people to do is not just to change, you know, a small thing in their life, not to just to change the people that they hang out with or the thoughts or I guess the things they believe, but you're actually asking them to change the way that they think, change the way that they would live.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there may not be an incentive for most people to do that. You know, and of course we're talking about a small group of people who may be inside of that religion and don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority are wholehearted in what they're doing.
Yeah.
The vast majority do truly believe what they're doing. So, I mean, like if you took my parents, if you asked them today, they would tell you that they're doing the right thing and they're doing the best thing that they can because they love me by not talking to me,
mm-hmm.
by shunning me, you know, and anyone that you would ask would feel that way. And they genuinely do, you know, they genuinely do. You know, obviously you would hope that people would change that a little bit and maybe see a more reasonable way about things.
Soften over time.
Yeah, but that's you know, that's just not the reality of how it is. It's you know, you're trained there you know, through many different devices to put your whole heart into it, to make it your whole life, mm-hmm. Which is what I did, which is why I ended up in the situation that I was, right, where my entire both, you know, social and financial work environment, all of that was wrapped up in one way or another tied to the religion and the organization. Yep.
Have you ever heard of sunken cost fallacy before? It's an economic thing, but it really, I think, applies to this.
Yeah, but go ahead and refresh me.
Okay, so basically it says that once you've committed so much resources to something, that to continue forward with it is your best bet, because otherwise you'd have to start over. But this is something that I think really does apply in this situation, where it's like everything in your life is wrapped up in one thing, and to simply start over means everything. You just don't have anything outside of what you know, which is all wrapped up in that ideology. And I mean, I question myself if I was in that situation, particularly if you're somebody who's older, right? If you're not earlier on in your life, just having the energy to put into starting completely over with a new network potential. I mean, this is assuming things go like as badly as they could, which is like you have to start over from scratch. To do that, it just requires insane amount of effort, an insane amount of courage, an insane amount of persistence and dedication. That I don't know. Do you think that there's like a set number of people that really have that, and that they could maybe lead others to think similarly? But there's that set of traits is kind of rare. I'm not telling you to call yourself a hero here, but I mean, you really do have a bunch of admirable traits that I think are somewhat unusual.
I mean, it could be. I, you know, obviously I appreciate that everybody would like to hear that, but I think I think it's rare in some instances, but I also think we see it a lot in everyday life. I think people take risks every day. Mm-hmm. We often just don't hear about the failures, you know, whether it's someone changing their careers, or whether it's, you know, someone who put their whole heart into something from the time they were 5 years old, or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. I think people are brave and courageous all the time in what they do. I just think when we see a success, we don't really think of it as brave, because it's a success for us, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's usually bravery is when we see something that someone's failed and they've continued to work on from that. Mm-hmm. So I think it is. I mean, like you said, the sunken cost goes into it. You have to, you know, make an evaluation every day. We make an evaluation, as you shared, you know, with your podcast, you made a similar one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I do think that those traits are rare. But I don't think it's something that's necessarily unique in and of itself. Mm-hmm. You know, even within the ex-Jehovah's Witness community, you see it quite a bit to varying degrees. I mean, you know, it's not something I barely tell people in my daily life, let alone speak about it in public. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got some people who are incredibly courageous, who have put themselves out there, who have lost everything, who have no contact with their families, or have no... You know, they no longer live the life that they used to live, and they're putting themselves out there for further ostracism from other groups by expressing these opinions, or by, you know, putting themselves out there so that someone like me can see a path that someone else already, you know, took. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really where I see somebody who's got that kind of quality that you need to move on from there. I think certainly in the eras that we're living in now, I think that goes into a lot of people's thinking when you categorized it at hive mind thinking. Mm-hmm. Think about the alternative for people, whether it's, you know, people who, like you said, are on the left or on the right or somewhere in the middle, wherever they may be. To make those changes takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of bravery to do that.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind delving a little bit into your marriage from when you were affiliated with the Jehovah's Witnesses? I know that there's a lot to that, but maybe either a summary or some of the highlights of...
Sure, I can give my experience from a... I think fairly common Jehovah's Witness experience for a young person.
Okay.
You know, for Jehovah's Witnesses, they're very strict in following what they believe the Bible says, in, you know, a literal sense, essentially.
Sure.
So especially for a young person growing up in the religion, it's drilled into you very early on what the proper way to behave, you know, is from a relationship standpoint or a sexual standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you find a lot of, even dating is very restricted within the religion. You can only date within the religion. You can't talk, you know, you can't have that kind of relationship outside.
Mm-hmm.
For people who do that, they experience a lot of ostracism and cutting off and things like that. But also with it being so restrictive from, you know, a young person who's coming into their own. So you see a lot of young marriages, and that was the case for me too. So,
mm-hmm.
I started dating my ex when I was about 20 years old, and we were married by the time we were 22. We were about 6 months apart in age, so essentially the same age. And honestly, I was kind of late for most of my friends. So most of my friends, you know, in my local group were all married by that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very often if you're a woman in the organization and you are 23 or 24 years old, you're looked on as like an old maid. You mm-hmm. know, there's like commonly jokes made about that. So that's a focus, not just from the sexual repression part of things, but also it's kind of like the next step in life for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the experience that I had, was getting married very young. And, you know, your whole life is kind of wrapped up in the religion. So your goals are supposed to be to further the religion. Your daily life is, you know, kind of impacted by that. It's very, very patriarchal. So, you know, the way that they view it is the man is the head of the house.
Mm-hmm.
The woman is subservient to him. And the same way that he would be to God.
Got it.
So, as you can imagine, as a 22-year-old, to have that kind of thing thrust upon you, you're given this this blueprint that's supposed to work because you know, God or whoever is claiming to be representative of him mm-hmm. gave you this blueprint, right? And so, you know, that's one of the subtle ways that they can control you, is by saying anytime that you might encounter a problem, you know, you have to go back to what God says. And what they mean when they say what God says, it's they always have a book for it, right? And that book comes from the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the experience that I had on that end of things, was really getting into a bad situation in marriage because of following, you know, what I thought the path was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can overcome and everything with that. So, you know, I found myself still fairly young, but in a marriage that was clearly failing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made the decision to try to get some help, right? Like you would do in that kind of a situation.
Of course.
So I actually confided, and this goes back to a little bit what we were talking to before. I had confided in a close friend of mine about some of the issues and, you know, that I thought it was time to make a move. And this was one of the indicators that I had that I really couldn't trust anybody, even someone that was my best friend from the time I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Because the immediate advice was go and talk to your local elders, right? Go and talk to your local elders. So I thought, you know what? This guy's my best friend. I knew he had been through some personal things as well. And I thought if it worked for him, maybe it'll work for me. So I'm going to give this another shot. So, you know, I went to my partner and I told her, I said, hey, let's really work on this. Let's go to the elders like we're supposed to do and see what they have to say to us. And I think I may have shared this with you. It was really eye-opening for me, because what I ended up finding out was I had these two men who, you know, in their defense, had all the best intentions in the world,
mm-hmm.
but just highly unqualified to be able to give the assistance that they were being asked to give. And so it was interesting because, you know, knowing them personally, one was a warehouse worker, one was a tile setter.
Oh, man. Not to say that a warehouse worker and a tile
exactly.
setter can't have some views on marriage.
Can't
on
have
marriage,
some views
but,
on marriage, right?
That's rough.
I mean, but when you're asking for something that should be given to someone who's had years of training
yeah.
and degrees on this. So what they did, I was 6 years into marriage at this point, I believe, and they gave us an article that had been written by the religion to help first year married couple or married couples get through the first year of marriage as newlyweds. And so for me, that was really eye-opening because I had gone all in again, and I said, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to take advantage of these resources that I've been told my whole life lead to happiness. And these poor guys were just like overwhelmed with what we told them and had no idea what to do, right? So they left that article, they read some scriptures, they said a prayer, and left. Mm-hmm. And when they left, I went, okay, I got to do something else.
Yeah.
Right?
Pretty much immediately.
I mean, it was a big factor. There were other factors that led to it. But I mean, if you were to put together the puzzle of Jake leaving, that would have been the borders of it, right?
Yeah.
Like that would have really what framed the picture for me was that in order for me to find happiness, it wasn't something that I could rely on what people had been telling me I could do to find happiness.
Got it.
So for me, I was then at that point where I had to decide what the rest of my life was going to look like. Because in my mind, I knew couples who were clearly not happy, but were still together because of being in the religion, because they didn't want to do something that would impact the rest of their lives by, you know, whether it was separating or getting a divorce or whatever the case may be. So for me, I had to say, well, do I want to be one of those people, or do I want to put it on the line and try to go out and find happiness somewhere?
Man, so you must have felt like a double agent.
For a bit, but not honestly not that long of a time.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was probably a good year, maybe a little bit more, that my mind was slowly being made up, you know, and it was kind of like a snowball effect. If I had that initial snowball of doubt, things that happened over that year just increased the size of it till eventually I could no longer, you know, hold that back, and it. You know, impacted my life.
Was it thrilling in its own way?
The last time I walked out of a kingdom hall, which is what they call their churches, is a kingdom hall.
Yeah.
That was thrilling.
Was that like taking your first breath after holding it for a long time? It seems like it would be like escaping a sinking submarine or something like that. I'm not saying that the chapter is a sinking submarine that you were part of, but I'm saying that in general, it's like, it just seems like I can't even fathom the amount of relief that I'm imagining would come with it, where you go, oh, I'm breathing for the first time, it seems like, on my own.
Yeah. There was definitely a huge sense of relief because, again, it's partial, right? It's these things that are slowly building up to become a belief and to become a truth that you now understand. So for me, while going through it, so initially, when you're leaving, when you've done something wrong, they do what's called, they shun you. They try to put a nice name on it. They call it disfellowshipping, but they shun you.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happens and you're being shunned in order to...
One second. Yeah. I just want to mention, it's essentially like, I think you and I both know with Scientology, being a suppressive person, right?
Yeah. I would say very similar to that. I think Scientology, or I don't think, I know Scientology is much more aggressive.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you've watched, you know, some documentaries on them, like Louis Theroux or something, you will see where they actively kind of harass suppressive people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a portion of that goes on with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, but not to that.
But not
Hollywood
to that extent. Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not a harassment so much as if they think you've done something wrong but haven't been able to catch you, they want to get you out.
Got it.
So like they might try to find things to get you out, but once you're out, they're not going to keep harassing you, kind of thing.
Okay, it's like abuse versus neglect almost.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Very similar. So, I mean, they like if, for instance, say that they were aware that my family was in contact with me or something to those effects, they might harass the family about that.
Oh, yeah.
To get them to stop associating.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't directly like harass me to cut my family off, if that makes sense.
Man, that's a tough one, though. But that's a tactic that's pretty common is, okay, if this person is all set on what they're doing, go for the family. That's a hard tactic.
Yeah, and they definitely pursue that very hard. They've actually doubled down on it in recent years. So, you know, one of the major sources of doctrine for Jehovah's Witnesses is they have a yearly convention every summer that all of the attendees go to. You know, it's different locations worldwide. And so this is kind of where they put on you know, there's a theme to it that is supposed to be the focus for the next year. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, they've had, you know, video demonstrations of how a parent should act if their child calls them on the cell phone, or, you know, and they show images of the parent seeing their child calling and mm-hmm. hanging it up and things like that, which is something I've seen my parents adopt as well.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of, you know, that sort of propaganda within that continues at a pretty high pace. Yeah.
So did you think that was, aside from the fact that you knew that this was most likely going on, do you feel like any of your interactions with your parents and your family felt scripted in a way that they were specifically, aside from that video that they were shown, handed something or told specifically directly them to say to you? Like apply this pressure in this sort of a way?
No, not necessarily. So there definitely is, I think it's a little bit more subtle in there.
Okay.
You know, I think it could be a case of where an elder might go to a parent and say, you know, how's your son doing? How's your daughter doing? That sure. sort of thing. And that'll be an indication to them whether or not you know what's going on in their life, right?
Got it.
So that sort of thing, they might actually, you know, use knowledge that they gain that way to apply the sort of pressure mm-hmm. onto them. But it's not necessarily so overt, you know, in doing that. But going back to what you said about the relief, that particular case was a huge relief to me because, you know, the broader point I was trying to make is that once you leave the religion, in order to get back, you have to keep doing all the routines, which means going to their meetings, but no one will talk to you, right? So mm-hmm. I was in a congregation made up of about 130 people. So these were people that the majority of them I had known my whole life. So I was going to a congregation the next town over from the one that I grew up in. So these people were people who I had known my entire life. And so that was definitely eye-opening to me to see, even though I had seen others go through this, to personally experience it was very different, to personally experience that kind of ostracism.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was a little bit of the final straw that helped me to get over that hurdle of going, am I making the right decision, right? Because even to the point, I mean, as we talked about, it's an integral part of your life. So even to the point where I had been cut off, I still was unsure if I had made the right decision, if I was ready to move on and to leave all this behind, or if it was something that I still wanted to pursue. And so that day that I was at the Kingdom Hall, and something happened that made me say, nope, this isn't the place for you. So that was thrilling. That was like taking a first breath, because finally I had gotten to that point that the indoctrination didn't have a hold of me anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, walking out, and I walked out in the middle of it, which was great. I didn't like wait to the end. I got there and was like, why am I here at like 9:30 on a Sunday morning for all these people who aren't going to talk to me when they're being told from this stage how like loving and forgiving God is?
Yeah.
And so I think I went out and I like went and like got some Chipotle and had a lazy Sunday, and it was the best thing ever.
Yeah, I think to get that affirmation, that sense of affirmation that you've been relying solely on yourself to give, and that nobody else has given you or will give you, to get that from something in your environment to reaffirm what you're doing must just be, like you say, thrilling. And I could imagine that that as you're leaving a situation like that, everything must feel like you're getting gaslit, that people are just, that everything must be confusing. I mean, it sounds like you were getting a bit more clarity, but in general, yeah. It seems like the environment gets more chaotic and you're being fed information that, you know, completely contradicts other information. You go, what's real anymore? What's mm-hmm. So there must be that clarity that you had amongst all that chaos and confusion. I can certainly see why that would be intoxicating.
Yeah. I mean, it was, I don't know about intoxicating, but definitely freeing. And it was a clarity that didn't exist before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most important part. And I still do this today. And you know, I'll tell my best friends this all the time, that even to this day, I take moments where I stop and I look back and I think and I ask myself, did you make the right decision?
Mm-hmm.
You know, And it's those sort of things. It's the facts. It's the critical thinking that leads to having that. Never once have I answered that question without 100% yes. Mm-hmm. You know, never once have I gone, well, maybe I should have, you know, given this another shot, or if I had tried this or that. And that's really what's freeing and what's intoxicating and what does embolden you to make those changes, because you know, the strength of your conviction, whatever that conviction may be, you know, that's why now being outside of it, I'm not a very active person when it comes to social issues or politics. It's definitely something that I'm interested in. But for me personally, I think it's okay to take a little bit of a break from that. Mm-hmm. And I still have such profound respect for people who do put themselves out there for a cause. You know, assuming the cause is an altruistic one, you know, who do put them out there, because there's so much effort that's involved in that and giving of yourself. But to see somebody who has that kind of conviction over whatever it may be is a truly impressive thing.
Yeah, I think that I could say, bordering on what you're discussing there, that I've thought the same thing about, and I know you said that Scientology, every case is quite different, but Scientology, of course, different, but has some similarities. And David Miscavige, the guy who's the head of Scientology and who has been since L. Ron Hubbard died, his father, Ron Miscavige, wrote a book that I had read a while back called Ruthless. And he talks about how, you know, despite the fact that there's this institution, this Church of Scientology that really controls the lives of the adherents, the principles of Scientology are still liberating for people, and you can still live by principles of Scientology outside of the institution. And I would imagine it's the same thing with any group, is that you still have, it's not like people in these situations are bad or anything like that. It's that there's tons of elements of their personalities that are wonderful.
So. Yeah. So I know within the XJW activist community, sometimes they'll have, you know, conversations around this topic about the leaders, right? So the leaders mm-hmm. of Jehovah's Witnesses call themselves a governing body.
Yeah.
Like 7 or 8 guys at this point. But in any event, you know, a lot of times they say, you know, do you think these people are actively manipulating people? You know, they would be in a similar position as what David Miscavige is, right, with Scientology.
And versus being sincere, is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
like insincerely
mm-hmm.
manipulating people?
Right.
Okay.
And I think these people truly believe it, right? They truly believe that it's like what makes a good villain, right?
Yeah.
In a movie, that villain 100% believes in the destructive thing that he believes is going to be for a greater good or for a greater personal gain.
Yeah, they believe they're the hero, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's pretty unique with Jehovah's Witnesses, because their beliefs, while they identify as a Christian religion, their beliefs vary quite wildly from what you would consider a standard Christian doctrine mm-hmm. or dogma. And the men who are at the head of the organization, wonderfully, who would have thought, they're the few chosen ones who are going to go to heaven, where the rest of Jehovah's Witnesses are going to live on the earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they feel that they have this authority. They feel that they have this power, that they are truly the ones on earth who God is talking through. And I think that's a sincere belief. Whether you want to get into how much or how little mental illness is involved in that, it's a sincere belief that's held by them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my take on it, is the manipulation and the controlling that goes along with it is coming from a place that there may not be a whole lot of logic there,
mm-hmm.
but there is a profound amount of passion and there is a profound amount of conviction with it. And that can be used for great good, like we talked about,
mm-hmm.
but also when it's held by people in positions of this kind of power, it truly does impact people in a negative way. So whether that's, you know, through a political organization that has that kind of a power, whether it's through, you know, large corporations that have that kind of a power, even though it's individual humans who may make up the people who are running that, you see where it can really be a negative influence.
Mm. Yeah, I think that I'm pretty much in full agreement with you there when it comes to, you should, in general, give people the benefit of the doubt when it comes to their sincerity with what they're advocating. And I think a lot of the time, the reason why people don't give that benefit of the doubt is because if they ascribe this kind of hive mind, this kind of cult mentality to somebody's sincerity rather than something that's off about that person, something innate about those people that fall into, you know, different religious sects or cults or whatever. If they don't ascribe it to something inherent to those people, then they're opening up the door to say that they themselves could be those people.
Right.
And that is extremely uncomfortable, I think, for most people to think about, is that the only thing that's separating themselves from, maybe not the only thing, but one of the main things separating themselves from the people in that situation is that their thing hasn't been put on a TV documentary yet, mm-hmm. or they're maybe not that far along yet, but yeah. It can be all types of things.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, I can echo experiences that I've seen, you know, in different documentaries or, you know, whether it's online or YouTube or whatever, of cult survivors from many different, many different organizations, mm-hmm. whether it be, you know, a religious organization like Scientology or Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever it might be. I found myself, in a lot of their experiences. Because, again, when you're inside it, I remember watching one documentary about a cult of one man, right? It was not a large one.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, while we were in it, like, I didn't think any of this was weird. I mean, these were people who were being physically, mentally, sexually abused. And they said, you know, we never thought that any of it was wrong. It was what he wanted, so mm-hmm. it's what we did. And I think it was because, like you said, they identified something greater than themselves. And that's, you know, every human wants to have an identity. And they were able to characterize how they viewed themselves in their own identity by attaching it to someone or something that they thought had greater value.
Mm-hmm.
And there's safety in that for people. There's safety in knowing that even if it's small in comparison to other organizations, that you have your people, right? That you have always that community that you're going to be safe inside. And so to take steps that are going to put that in jeopardy is terrifying for people. You know, and it's not something I think the average person can really wrap their head around and make the decision to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that's kind of like an understatement, and probably also the deep spiritual compassion that people have for the people that that are in the same situation that they are, I think probably makes it more difficult to parse what is improper or questionable behavior from what you would otherwise identify as unacceptable in other people that you don't have that compassion for.
Yeah, and I think we see that a lot on the political scene now, right? Where there's no longer two sides of the story, there's two different stories, right?
Oh yeah.
And
different screens, right?
Right.
Same movie or same theater, different movies playing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it all goes back to that, you know, in varying degrees. But I mean, that's really the decision that I think a lot of people, I think back to the last election and the, you know, in the aftermath of the surprise win by Trump, there was lots of analysis of like, how did we not see this coming kind of thing. And mm-hmm. one of the ones that jumped out to me that I really noticed personally was, especially in middle America, they felt that they were losing who they were as Americans mm-hmm. because America was changing, right? And that was the thing that was most terrifying for them, was that they were either afraid to lose what they had or that what they had was going to change into something they didn't recognize. And that can be the greatest prison of any, right? Like yeah. you said, you don't have to be physically threatened. I was never physically threatened in my nearly 30 years of being in that organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there are times when you do feel that there is no way out, that there's absolutely no other option. You know, it's really an amazing part of human psychology.
Yeah.
You know, that's a reality, and you know, that's why I like, you know, I think these kind of conversations, and not that my story is unique, but I think it's important to get different stories out there, because there are so many there's such a wide spectrum of experiences within those same things, right? So a person who's part of any other religion or any other organization could be experiencing the same thing that I did, just, you know, the opposite side of the coin of that. Because at the end of the day, we're all humans who have the same type of experiences, but we handle them differently and we react to things differently because of what our physical or mental makeup may be. So I think it's really important to always apply critical thinking, to always look at what all the options are, educate yourself to the best ability that you can, which thankfully we have now more than ever before in humans' history, right? With access to the internet and different resources. So I think it's incredibly valuable for individuals to use that to understand themselves, but also to understand other people better.
What you just said about essentially the experience that you were describing being similar to other experiences, that is absolutely one of the reasons that I wanted to bring you on here tonight, was because I think that there is such an that although your experience is unique in many ways, it's very much analogous to all types of situations that people might find themselves in where they feel trapped, like you were describing, like they feel like there's no way out. So I think a lot of the utility that your experiences can have, as uncomfortable as they were at the time, obviously your own personal, emotional, spiritual growth is one of the utilities of what you live through, and also the ability to kind of help other people see situations that they might be in, situations that people that they love might be in, or just kind of, you know, being aware for the future for something that they might come across, or maybe to view the world. And what you have described tonight is really eye-opening in the sense that you can view the world in an entirely different way if you're aware of what you just described. So I just quickly want to, because it's 7:45, so we're 3/4 of the way through the program, I just wanted to say, first of all, that the studio line, if you wanted to call in, was once again 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. And those last four digits are WMFO, which is the station that you're listening to. So I should say, if you just tuned in at some point in the program in the middle and didn't know what you're listening to, you are listening to Man vs. Mob Radio. I'm your host, Patrick Clerkin, and I've been talking to my roommate, Jake, for the last 45 minutes about his experiences as a former Jehovah's Witness, him leaving the Jehovah's Witnesses, and really his life after and what he's done. So we've been talking about sort of hive mind and being a independent and critical thought and such. So if you have any input that you'd like to give, any questions that you'd like to ask, once again, the number is 855-915-9636. So I guess it's time for the PSA that we do every episode. So Jake, if you have found one that you would like to share, please do.
I do. I have one that I'm very passionate about here. Patrick, do you have a camera on your laptop?
I do, actually.
Well, why not cover your computer camera? If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up.
There you go. I actually like that advice. And you know what? I think that I saw that advice in here, and because there is currently a piece of tape over my camera on my laptop,
yeah,
and it's a piece of blue painter's tape, so I could really upgrade the tape that I'm using. But yeah, that's good advice. And there was a Snowden interview on Joe Rogan recently, so maybe that will be the follow-up PSA, is check that out.
Yeah.
It can explain all types of things to you. So one thing that I did want to bring up, in that we touched upon, you had really brought it up during the first conversation that we had, but there is what's the guy's name? Oh, Stephen Hassan, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about him, or
sure.
Are you an advocate of what he says, or are you sort of skeptical of it? Or I actually, interestingly enough, I was at a this past weekend at a bachelor party in Denver. And one of the conversations that I had with one of the other people at that bachelor party was about Stephen Hassan's bite model. And are you familiar with that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So pretty much the question is open to anything Stephen Hassan related or bite related.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, necessarily like an expert on everything that the man believes or says or teaches, but his interviews were integral to me. Mm-hmm. Because I think he personally, he was interviewed on a YouTube channel.
Wait a second. Who is he first? I guess you should.
So don't quote me on his exact credentials, but he is a professor who has expertise in high control or cult organizations.
Okay.
And has really put a lot of his effort and research into identifying how they work, why people are part of them, and also assisting in people, becoming free from them.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly worth the listener's time to take a look at him and some of the research and things that he's done. But I mean, for me personally, it was incredibly valuable because he put together a list of the most common, I think it was 8 different characteristics of high control organizations. And, one of the things I probably don't, he sugarcoats it a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
A high control organization is a cult or something similar to that, right?
Got it.
So, he had, because being one of Jehovah's Witnesses, there's a certain arrogance that comes with being a Jehovah's Witness because, mm-hmm. Just to sum it up briefly, what they kind of believe is that everybody else is going to die, but they're going to live when God passes judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's a certain arrogance that comes with that because as you're interacting with everyone else around you who's not one of Jehovah's Witnesses, it's in the back of your mind that they're doing everything wrong and you're doing everything kind of right.
Mm-hmm.
And, One of the ways that Jehovah's Witnesses express that in the community, almost in a joking way, is about other cults. Like, oh yeah, aren't they weird or that, but aren't we lucky to have the truth?
Yeah.
And so, the talk of a cult or anything is nothing that shied away from. I mean, you're aware inside of it that other people might view you like you're in a cult, and it became almost a source of humor. But for me, it was very interesting because this Stephen Hassan put together this list. And as I read this list for the first time and looked at it objectively, I realized that all of those characteristics were a part of my life or a part of what my life had very recently been. And for me, that was just... that was almost confirmation that, okay, because at this point I was outside. The interesting thing with me is even though I was having those doubts, I didn't really take steps to do in-depth research on those doubts I was having until I had left.
Yeah.
And so as I was doing this, it was very much confirmation for me to see that. And it was like a slap in the face to go,
oh, yeah.
Wow. Like,
pretty shocking.
Yeah, to like, see tick, like, tick, hey, tick, that applies to me. And not like, oh, one or two of those, like liken it to astrology, right? Sometimes it you might feel that it's generalized and you're like, oh, yeah, I could see that in me, but that doesn't
matter. Oh, I'm hardworking.
This was like, this was almost like having my whole life just laid out in front of me.
Yeah.
That, in big words, you were in a cult, right? And so that was also very, very liberating. And I know... again, it's not a huge passion of mine because I have the attitude of, that was what my life was and I want to go on and live my own life for the rest of the time that I have. And but I do know he does a lot of work with Scientologists and others, to help people identify when they're part of this, right? When they mm-hmm. might be part of a high control organization or part of an abusive situation. So I think it's definitely, well worth the time to look it up. I think either this past weekend or sometime shortly in the future, he's having a forum in New York that kind of applies his thinking and his methods to, those who would consider themselves to be, loyal to Trump. And how mm-hmm. that might interact. So,
sure.
I mean, that's he does a lot of work on smaller organizations, but he also does apply it to, some of the things that I think are of broader interest to people.
I really would like to know more about him. And I should say to listeners who might be interested in looking up his name or his model, His name, once again, is Stephen Hassan, and that's H-A-S-S-A-N. And the model he uses is the BITE model, which is actually an acronym, B-I-T-E. And the B is behavioral control, the I is information control, the T is thought control, and the E is emotional control. So I guess that one last thing that I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if you know any of these people, Jake, but this is something that's fascinated me for the last couple months, is there are sort of specialists based on the different groups that are out there and who do work with these different groups. And I'm really grateful that they're out there. But one of them you mentioned, Louis Theroux, he's not necessarily particular to any group, but he was a BBC documentarian, and he went and stayed with these very odd subcultures of the United States and maybe elsewhere as well. But he really sat down and interviewed people and really kind of gained enough of an emotional connection with these with these various people that they laid out their beliefs to him in all their inconsistency. And I think a lot of them actually realized when they stated them so openly, because nobody was, you know, like antagonizing them or criticizing them. It's almost like they were led to just understand themselves, some of the contradictions. And maybe you've heard the expression, give somebody enough rope to hang themselves, basically. That's kind of what he does. Yeah. But then there's a couple other people. There's Daryl Davis, who you might know. He had a documentary on Netflix called Accidental Courtesy, and he went to former members of the Ku Klux Klan. He's a black guy, by the way. He used to work with Chuck Berry. He's a jazz blues musician. And Daryl Davis goes around to different chapters of the Klan. He's convinced by his counts about 60 to 80 people to leave the Klan. There's Leah Remini with Scientology, which I know that she's got some controversy around her, but in general, what she's trying to do, I think, is pretty good. And there's also Megan Roper Phelps, who is a former member of the Westboro Baptist Church. And let's see, one more. Hassan Nawaz, I believe, who is former Islamic fundamentalist of some kind. So anyway, I'm bringing all these up because I think that the real importance is to maintain the dialogue with people, like never write people off. It really bugs me when people say that person is a lost cause. Let's just count them out. So whoever you are, whatever you're into, just maintain dialogues with people, and you'll learn as much from them. Don't have the air of moral superiority that you're only going to teach them. You're going to learn as probably as much from them as they are from you. So, I mean, I don't know if you have any advice for people or any resources or anything that you wanted to say, but
yeah, definitely. I would say, in general, if you're more interested in you know, my experience in Jehovah's Witnesses, there's definitely a couple resources I would point you towards. I know there's a book that recently came out that's been pretty popular called, it's from, her name is Amber Scora, and it's called Leaving the Witness. And it's her experience. You know, I said I was pretty heavily involved. If I was pretty heavily involved, she was, you know, involved 10 times as much as I was.
Yeah.
So her experience is very eye-opening and enlightening. Also, there's lots of different activists on YouTube. But to you know, I think make a final point with what you were just saying about aggressive activism, I can tell you, I think that, you know, if you are passionate about something, the way to approach it is exactly how you said, to have an open mind and to try to connect with people. Aggressive activism is something that I'm aware of from when I was a child. And, you know, it was something that was prevalent. Jehovah's Witnesses would call them apostates, and it might be people who are like outside one of the venues with signs, essentially picketing, right? Their own views. And that's easy to demonize. That's really easy to demonize and to point to, you know, the inherent flaws in that kind of behavior, that kind of aggressive behavior. Whereas on the opposite, when you are really connecting and you have a clear, passionate message for people, that's where you're going to make a real difference. So whatever the case may be, whether it's, you know, something that you're personally passionate about, or that you've decided is your, you know, your life's passion, that you want to influence others on, I would say in general that's the way to go. And I think if we saw more of that in our country now, that we would have a better one.
Yeah, I'm fully with you there. People need to see the sincerity and that you really actually care about their well-being and that you have empathy. So the more people that can display that, I think for sure the better. So we're at the end of the program. We have about 30 seconds left. And I just wanted to say, honestly, really thank you for being willing to come on tonight and to share all that. I know it's a very personal story, but I hope that it gives you some amount of satisfaction to share it with other people and to be on a venue that you can say it how you want to say it rather than having people badger you or anything.
No, I do. I appreciate you having me on. But once again, my true passion, people, is tape your laptop cameras.
Remember the PSA, people.